Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back here on the program once again Phil Nixon. He's an extension specialist from the University of Illinois who deals with insect pests around the home and has for a long, long time been here on this program fairly regularly, certainly when the insects are active, to try to help people out with insect problems. So if you got something that's in the house that's causing you a problem, could be also something in the home landscape, the things that kind of get after the garden and the ornamentals, the things that are around the outside. Call in and tell us what it is, and he will first say, well, okay, are you sure you can't live with this thing? But if you can't live with this thing, okay, we'll tell you what to do. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Any point here, you can give us a call. Well, thanks very much again for being here.
Glad to be here.
We have somebody ready to go already. I will, rather than make them wait, we'll get right to them. And it's line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a problem of tiny insects that seem to like a particular window, although they can be very partial to the screen of a computer. And will they go away and die out, or will I have an infestation forever?
What do they look like? Do they look like tiny beetles or tiny flies?
Tiny. One look at first, it could look like a gnat, and it seems to jump, or it's a little bit bigger than that. And these are very tiny, the kind that you'll see come in front of your face when you're walking outside.
Well, there's a variety of things that it could be. The ones that tend to be outside are fungus gnats, and we do get fungus gnats also coming out from houseplants, which could be a source if you may be watering too often, or if you have plants that need to be watered a lot, like ferns, then there may be, there's insecticidal soap can go in the soil. Otherwise, there are too many other little things that could possibly be coming. There are grain beetles that could do this situation. There could be other insects that could come in and do the same thing. So you're probably best off to get a sample and take that to your local extension office, because once you know what it is, and there are too many little things that it could be. Once you know what it is, then normally the control of these types of insects is finding their source and taking care of that.
Okay. What is a fungus fly? And that sounds kind of ominous.
Fungus gnat feeds on fungi, and anytime you have dead organic matter and moisture, does that sound like this spring? You're going to get fungus gnats. The larvae feed on that material. Of a fungus that grows on that material, on dead organic matter, and then will come out in large numbers. And the swarms we've been seeing throughout the spring this year are primarily batches of males. They hang out in big masses to attract females to them, and this is how they find their mates. So they will hover over anything vertical, particularly. So if you're standing talking to somebody, before long you'll have a mass of fungus gnats flying around the top of your head. But these are, we have those in the spring, and we have them in the fall, usually more in the fall, but with our wet spring we've had a very large number of those. But what might be happening inside is probably generated inside, and we need to, and knowing what it is for sure will be a better answer.
Well, we're very careful. The word fungus scares me, frankly. So we're extremely careful, and don't leave wet things around and get right to the laundry and things of that sort. But will they just eventually die if they don't?
It depends what they are, and I don't know what they are.
If they are fungus flies, would they eventually?
No,
die?
It depends on what their source is. So again, finding out what it is, taking it to a local extension office.
Okay.
I've really gone as far as I can with you on this one.
Okay. Thank
without knowing more.
Right. I have another question, and that is I've seen ads for spray something on your lawn and get rid of fleas and ants and all kinds of bugs like that. Is that a dangerous kind of spray? spray?
Anything that would be applied that way would be have gone through a considerable amount of research and so on, and it had been registered by the United States Environmental Protection Agency. Generally, the amount of research involved is usually somewhere in the range of $20 to $40 million on a single product. So, a tremendous amount is known about this. Essentially, about as much is known as about these things as the medications that you take. And as we know, occasionally there are medications which slip by that can be a problem, but most of them are not because of the testing that goes on ahead of time. Similar things associated with insecticides and other pesticides that can be applied that may be available outdoors or indoors or whatever the case may be. But generally, we recommend in an integrated pest management program that you focus on particular pests rather than carte blanche, spray everything and kill everything, and somehow that'll make it better. That doesn't make it better. That just disrupts nature, what little nature we have outside. So we don't recommend spraying on a calendar basis to control whatever might be out there. We recommend that instead, if you want to have somebody do this type of thing, there are plenty of companies who will look and scout. It's called scouting first and determine what's there in the way of insects, diseases, or weeds, and then respond appropriately. Sometimes there are cultural methods that can be done, the way you grow the plants, how you water, etc. And other times there are pesticides that are the best option, but they are targeted and used only when they're needed. And that's what we recommend.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Extension entomologist Phil Nixon. He's here to try to help out with insect pest problems. So if you call in, tell us, you know, give us the best description you can so we know what it is we're talking about. And then he can tell you how to approach dealing with the problem. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Another caller here, line two, they're next. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, so we've been renting a really old house for 7 years, and now mm-hmm. that we're moving, we're pulling up boxes from the basement, and we're stirring up cockroaches, and I don't want to bring them to our new location. Do you have any suggestions that we might be able to do with all the boxes in the moving van or something like that?
Well, there's several things that can be done. One thing is if you primarily have roaches in the basement and it's an older house, particularly if it's out near a wooded area, these may be wood roaches, which are native to the United States, and thus will not reproduce and become a problem inside the house.
Okay.
There can also be oriental cockroaches, known as water bugs, or American cockroaches in a damp situation such as this. And these are, despite their name, are from Africa, tropical Africa, and will reproduce inside a new place that you go to. So they can be a problem depending on what species you have. Generally, the best thing to do to get rid of roaches many times is to make sure that all of your belongings are exposed to 3 days of freezing temperatures. This will kill all stages of tropical roaches that will reproduce inside, eggs, everything. And in the wintertime, that's easily done, particularly in the northern part of the state, by just keeping things in an unheated shed or garage for 3 days when the temperature doesn't get above freezing for 24 for those 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have access to chest-type freezers or something of this nature, things may be able to be cycled through that. Another way to avoid roaches is to, when you move to your new place, unpack the same day you move, or bring boxes into the house before you're ready to unpack. You have some sort of garage or outside building otherwise to store them in until then, and you essentially unpack the box in the middle of an open, empty room so that anything that runs from there you can stomp before it gets to the baseboard.
Right.
And that's an effective method as well. And then you do not leave the boxes inside your house overnight.
Okay.
Because things will be hiding in there that'll crawl out during the nighttime.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Next, we'll talk with somebody who is on the road north of Champaign-Urbana, line three. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a quick question. I have something chewing up my deck. They look like yellow jackets. I think somebody told me they're wood wasps, perhaps.
Okay.
And I keep filling the holes with twigs, and then they just make new holes. So I'm just curious, is there a way to get rid of those?
Generally, by putting Carbaryl, which is sold as seven dust, around the opening, this dry dust will pick up on their body hairs, whether you have... you may have carpenter bees or other insects like this would pick that up, and in their grooming they will ingest it, and it will kill off the individuals as they go in and out of the net openings, out of the holes. Leave those holes open for the season because they have probably, what they're doing in there is they're hauling out the wood to start to raise young, and they're probably already provisioned those.
Yeah.
So if you leave the hole open, the young will come back out that main hole. There's no practical way to kill those inside the wood your situation. So, and then in the fall of the year, if you caulk those holes and put some sort of paint or paintable stain on the wood, this will probably reduce the likelihood of them attacking in the future.
Okay. And what did you call that powder?
Seven Dust, S-E-V-I-N, Dust, D-U-S-T.
All right, thank you.
Uh-huh. All right, and back here to line number one, someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Phil. This is Ron McGinley.
Hi.
This is fortuitous. Just this morning, somebody from Facilities and Services brought in a fairly large moth larva. It's about an inch and a half long. It's very dark, almost black, with very distinctive, pale, multi-pronged setae. And I'm wondering if, off the top of your head, do you know what that might be? It's chewing up ornamental plants.
Okay, generally, this gentleman is works with the Illinois Natural History Survey. I happen to know him. What you have is if a caterpillar has protrusions off of it with number of spines on it, that almost assuredly makes it a butterfly larva of one sort or another. And one of the more common ones at this time of year feeding ornamental plants is going to be the morning cloak butterfly larva. It will be found feeding on willows. I believe it also feeds on maples.
That's exactly what it was.
It normally will have red spots down the back if it's a morning cloak butterfly larva as well. But it'll be very dark otherwise.
Very, very dark otherwise, yeah. Okay, well, I'll pass this on to him.
So then you have a choice of whether you want to put up with a little bit of damage and enjoy the butterflies or not.
That's going to be his problem. Okay, thanks so much.
All right, thank you for the call. Other folks are welcome to call with questions about insect issues, pest problems, if it's something inside the house, something in the home landscape around the house, give us a call. And our guest, Phil Nixon, will do his best to tell you what it is and how to deal with it. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, we have some time here where we don't have any calls. I know you'd like to say a couple things about National Pollinator Week.
Yeah, we're looking at National Pollinator Week is occurring next week. The University of Illinois, particularly the Entomology Department at University of Illinois, I don't happen to be in that department, is having a variety of events on campus and around the Champaign-Urbana area, in libraries, nature center, et cetera, next week. And there's a lot of things. There's an art show. There's how to photograph bees and other pollinators, some children programs, a bee identification workshop, bee spotter workshop, things of this nature. And if you want more information, you can go to their website at www.life.uiuc.edu/entomology/pollinators. That's www.life.uiuc.edu/entomology/pollinators. And you'll get to their website that has all sorts of information on that. And, we're seeing a drop. We're getting some attention. We just had a program earlier this week. I can plug WIOL-TV for a nature program associated with colony collapse disorder and the reduction of honeybees. One thing that is not making the national news media, that particularly in the western part of the United States, we are on the verge of possibly having some native bees that are very important in pollination and our general structure of ecology going extinct from problems associated with them that are being worked on. In fact, some research being done here at the university on those. it's not a far-fetched thing to consider that maybe some of our Midwestern native pollinators might be a ways, not be far behind. And so realize 80% of a plants you see out there are flowering plants that rely on native pollinators and imported pollinators such as a honeybee. So being more aware and getting involved in this is an important thing.
Yeah, that was something that when I think it wasn't the last time that May was here, we've talked about it a lot when May Barenbaum has been on the show about colony collapse disorder.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about this particular issue that the European honeybee has been studied a lot,
right?
Because it's at the center of an important industry, not only producing honey, but also it's recognized what an important pollinator it is.
Yeah, it's probably one of the top 10 insects in the world that we know the most about. Yeah.
And then she said, but you also have to consider that here on this continent, there are many, many native bee species, but they have not been studied right. Nearly as much, and they also have important roles as pollinators, but there's just not a lot we know about them. And she said, you know, that it could be that that the native bee species are having serious issues too, and we might not even know about it because we just don't have that much data. We don't spend that much time collecting information about them.
Yeah, the concern is that these could quietly disappear. And then all of a sudden we start noticing that some of our native plants are disappearing, even ecological systems disappearing and collapsing. And so so being on top of this thing is important. And part of what they're working with is trying to get some bee spotters out there to find out, particularly with native pollinators, bees and wasps and butterflies and moths and flies and beetles are all pollinators. Being on top of what's happening there and starting to get some data, finding out whether there's, in fact, a reduction in some of these pollinators or not. Right now, we don't know because, research goes where the money is, and the money hasn't been in this area of study for particularly our native pollinators. And so that's something that's important. We don't even know whether we're losing the problem to even address it. So this is where a citizen network of bee spotters can help tremendously because the funds aren't really there to do the basic research to find out where we even have a problem.
All right. Well, we got some other folks here to talk with. Let's do that. And we have another caller, line one, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I had a question on carpenter ants outside the house and sometimes inside.
Uh-huh.
I had them sprayed for them last year and also in the around the house and also in the crawl space area down by the base of the foundation. That's something you just have to do every year?
You want to try to reduce the, first off, to keep carpenter ants out of your house from outside surf sources. Make sure that you don't have limbs within 3 feet of your house roof. They will come off of those limbs into your house.
Right.
And, of course, if you have limbs that close, you can also have in storms. Have those wearing holes in your roof, too. So there's a double reason there.
Right.
Reduce the amount of dead organic matter if it stays moist around your foundation. Reducing the amount of mulches. If you do have an organic mulch, a bark mulch, have that only a couple inches deep at the most so that it dries out between rains. And this will help reduce the problem, but sometimes you'll get ants trailing in anyway. And if they are coming from the outside, a foundation spray, if they become noticeable, can help stop that situation. Unlike other ants, we don't have very reliable baits. There was one on the market a few years ago, but it's kind of passed out of availability. So
for carpenter ants?
Yes, for carpenter ants. So we really are resorting to more in the way of sprays.
Yeah.
If a person sees a dozen or more carpenter ants in the house a day, generally that indicates that there's a nest inside the house, and that's going to be in a place that has gotten where the wood has gotten damp, typically within the last 5 years from a roof leak or water drain pipe leak. And if you can locate that area and replace the wood or spray the wood, the nest area, this will eliminate those individual nests and then stop the damp wood.
I guess DDT would get rid of them, wouldn't it, if we had DDT anymore?
If we had DDT anymore, it would, and you'd put it around your house, and you wouldn't have to worry about it for 10 years, but you might miss some of the birds outside, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I have a wood-burning stove, and I do have a lot of wood outside, but it's about, 15, 20 feet from the house, and then an old silver maple that I know has had a nest in it before, and we treated it, but that's something we could treat too, right?
Yes. I like to make the comment that if you live in the U.S. and you stare at a tree that's a larger tree at the trunk during the summer for 5 minutes, you don't see a carpenter ant go up, but you've had your eyes shut.
Yeah,
they are
right.
Essentially trees and carpenter ants go together. They nest in dead wood in a tree, including the center of the trunk of a tree, which is
okay.
dead wood.
Yeah.
And so the poorer shape the tree's in, the more carpenter ants are likely to be associated with it. But many times those are doing their thing outside, and an occasional ant inside is, I commonly will recommend if you see one or two ants a week, your best option may be to get up when you see that ant, stomp it, and
right.
not worry a whole lot about doing a whole lot of else spraying. And you not only are keeping the ants down, but also getting some good exercise. So,
right.
So in general, an occasional ant, don't get too concerned about. They're probably just looking for food coming in from outside, but a dozen or more
right.
a day, you need to find a source.
Yeah.
They're not a major wood destroyer because they hollow out the wood to live in. They don't eat the wood.
Okay.
So usually the nest is no more than a foot or two along a 2x4 or something when
yeah.
it's in the house.
All righty. Appreciate
right.
it.
Thank you for the call.
Have a good day, bye.
All right, thank you. So here is the bottom line is if you were either going to have termites or carpenter ants and you had your choice, you'd rather have
yeah,
carpenter ants.
You see advertisements on television that say carpenter ants are the second biggest destroyer of wood in the United States behind termites, which is true. Probably termites account for somewhere around 95-96% of a damaged wood, destroyed wood, and termites and carpenter ants for the next maybe percent and a half. So they're number two. But the difference between number one and two is gigantic and immense. And so, it helps sell their services, but it's really kind of, well, they're not really lying with statistics. It's not telling you the whole story. So, I would much prefer to have carpenter ants. And I even had them one time in a window in my house. And once we got the window fixed and the area was allowed to dry out, carpenter ants disappeared on their own. So sometimes, and we didn't spray or we just replaced some of the wood. I know we didn't get it all, but they just gave up after the wood got dried. That doesn't always, you're not always that lucky, but because they will live in dry wood, but they normally start in damp wood.
Yeah, all right. Phil Mixon is our guest. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I, and every once in a while he's here and helps out with insect pest problems around the home. You have a problem, give us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So when will we start to see Japanese beetles?
Japanese beetles, let me see, this is the 17th.
Yeah.
We expect emergence anywhere from the 24th to the 28th of June.
Next week.
Japanese beetles. And there's a variety of ways to control these. For those people who haven't had the pleasure of meeting these creatures, they're 3/8 to a half an inch long, stocky in shape. Beetles, very roundish looking, metallic green with coppery wing covers, and they'll be feeding on the upper leaves and flowers of roses, lindens, willows, birches, crab apples, fruit trees, variety of things. You can control them fairly easily by hand if you get onto them early. The Japanese beetles fly to a new host every 3 days, and they're here for 6 weeks, so they're here to about the middle of August. They will feed at the tops of plants. If you go out in the evening or the morning, early morning, with a wide mouth container, a jar with soapy water or rubbing alcohol in it, as you poke at each beetle, they will fold their legs and drop straight down and land in that liquid and die. In the middle of the day, they'll fly up into your face, so it doesn't work so well in the middle of the afternoon. But if you can keep the beetles off of your plants for the first week, week and a half, 2 weeks, even though they're there for 6 weeks, when they fly from plant to plant, they go to plants that have already been fed upon by Japanese beetles. And so if you can keep the damage off early, then you won't have much of a problem for the rest of the season. You can also go an insecticide route, and there you're looking at sprays of carbaryl, Sodus 7. This would be usually a liquid application in this case of 7 insecticide, or cyfluthrin, which is available to the homeowner under Bear Advanced Multi-Insect Killer. And these sprays can be put on once every 2 weeks, typically will provide control. So about 3 sprays on the plants that are particularly important in your landscape. Those, you might spray a small crab apple next to your front yard, a rose bush next to your back door, things like that. And with the roses, you would, if it's a single flowered rose or anything in bloom, you would try to spray in the evening and avoid the 7 insecticide, which is very toxic to our bees we've been talking about. But the cyfluthrin would be more, would be less of a problem. But only treat those trees and shrubs and so on that are really obvious with the damage. If you've got trees that are in less important parts of your landscape, something that essentially keeps you from seeing the garbage can or is back on the back part or away from a house to where you don't see it real close, you don't need to necessarily treat those. They're not going to cause the plant to die. They may slow its growth. They may look a little bad, but doing nothing is an option with Japanese beetles, and this will help reduce the amount of insecticides that's used.
Right. And one of the things that we know about insect populations is that they have natural rises and falls,
right,
depending on what's happening in the environment. Some of them may be susceptible to it being dry. They're susceptible to particularly those who are overwintering. If it's cold enough, down deep enough in the soil, that's going to have,
right,
an effect.
Right.
Is there any, given the winter that we had, the spring that they had, is there any way to predict either this is going to be a bad year or not so bad or don't know?
I'm kind of walking on the fence on this one because I predicted a heavy year last year and it just didn't happen. We got only about a third or a quarter of the number of beetles I was expecting last year. And I don't know still why that was, because we got heavy populations in southern Illinois and heavy populations in northern Illinois. Some reason, particularly in the Champaign-Urbana area over to Springfield area, we got almost a pittance of what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. So certainly there's been the things that tend to reduce Japanese beetles are dry conditions through the fall. From the time the Japanese beetles larvae hatch, which are white grub, which will feed on turf roots, in the early part of August, latter part of July, through the time that they go down deeper in the soil later in the fall, which is probably late September, October, they need about 11 inches of rainfall. And we got that last year. So that's not going to be a problem. And even when they don't get it, we have enough people watering their lawns that they provide it. It's nice of them to do that for the beetles. They appreciate that. A little bit of sarcasm there. And then the other thing is we had, although we look at the winter as being particularly nasty, it was a great winter for insects. It didn't get real cold. We didn't have temperatures well below zero for very long. We had just a couple days of one or two below, nothing serious. When we did, we had pretty good snow cover. We complained about the snow. The snow insulates the insects and helps them overwinter better, keeps the soil from getting too cold. And then we didn't have any January thaws, warm-ups that could tend to mess up the insect cycle. It stayed cold, which is ideal for bugs again. So we tend to think of last winter being particularly bad. It was fabulous for insects. So now the spring's been nasty to a lot of the things because we have a lot of fungi that attack caterpillars and so on. And with the wet weather we've had and the cooler weather we've had, spring-occurring insects have really taken it on the chin this year from fungal diseases, so we're not seeing as many caterpillars and other sorts of things on trees and shrubs as we commonly would. Mosquitoes are doing great, but other than that, the other things aren't. But the beetles, realized Japanese beetles were underground, so all this damp soil and so on, unless you had water standing for days at a time to probably takes several days to drown a white grub underground in that soil. By that time, you've lost your grass, too. So generally, the spring and the winter hasn't done a whole lot to reduce Japanese beetles, in my opinion.
Okay. And if you do have a particular plant in the landscape, you know that they like it, and
right,
you really like to prevent the damage, you can spray that. But you would say you don't spray until you actually see the beetles?
Right. You would not spray until you see the beetles. Same thing for hand-picking is what we call a drop, knocking them off. If two or three or four days saved before the beetles come to your plants is two or three days that you didn't have to have an insecticide there.
Okay. I had some other callers here, and next we'll talk with someone in Urbana. Line one.
Hi. I have, mm-hmm, a question about carpenter bees and, uh-huh, getting rid of them. They're not as active as they were about a week or two ago, but they've been boring holes in wood, and I was wondering whether 7 would work. I read about something on the Internet called dryone dust.
Dry-on dust is a mixture of diatomaceous earth with a pyrethroid in it. It will work well against as a dry dust against carpenter bees, or it should. We also recommend 7-dust carbaryl around the opening. It has to be a dry dust so that as the bees go in and out of the opening, the holes in the wood, they will pick this up on their body hairs, and then in their grooming they ingest the insecticide. And this will kill those individuals laying the eggs. Now, you want to leave the holes open. Don't caulk them shut, because particularly by now, there are what they're doing in there is they're building along, they're hollowing out a tube in that wood that they make cells into, that they provision with pollen and lay eggs in, and you'll have larvae now inside the wood feeding on that pollen that the adults gathered. And later in the summer, early fall, those bees will emerge, and if you leave the main hole open, they will come out of that hole that the female used, their mother used. If you close that hole off, each one will typically make its own hole. And so instead of having one hole, you'll have 4, 5, or 6 in a nice straight line down the board as each one makes its own hole out to the outside. Once you get into the fall, caulk those holes and then apply paint or paintable stain over it. And although this is not a sure bet to keep out carpenter bees, it's been my experience 80-90% of the time they don't come back to that wood if it's got a coat of paint or another solid surface across that wood.
Okay, so a little bit of dust injected in there now, and yeah, leave it open until fall.
Yeah, actually just a little dust around the opening. You can put a little bit on a tissue and just daub it around the opening. Whatever hangs is enough.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. To Gridley, this is the next caller, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I have an insect that's rather new to the area, I believe. Took me a while to identify it. It's called a green June beetle, and was wondering how to control it. Most of the information I get is from the East Coast, the Maryland area, where they are more prevalent, I guess you'd say. And it says that you can't really kill the adults because they don't really feed on anything. Are you familiar with green June beetles?
Yeah, we've had them here for hundreds of years. They have increased since the mid-1990s when they closed the landfills to yard debris. Green June beetles are about an inch long, and they're metallic green, and they fly during the middle of the summer in sunny situations, and they seem to like to fly into people, and they'll hit you in the throat or the forehead or something like this, going probably about 15 miles an hour, and you feel like you got hit with a big bullet. Control of them is going after the larvae, the immature stage. The larvae feed on dead grass, and if people are piling up, collecting grass clippings and piling them up, that will be a source for them. Stables with horse bedding stored up or other types of dead vegetation material is also a source for them. If you make sure that these piles are composted, or in the case of grass clippings, don't collect them in the first place, this will greatly reduce the number of green June beetles. Occasionally we get green June beetles that will get half-inch holes or something, particularly underneath a tree, and the larvae will come out at night to feed. We can get good control with a drench of carbaryl 7 insecticide on those. But generally, in most areas in this part of the state, they're coming out of places where people have piled up grass clippings rather than leaving them lie on the lawn or making those into compost piles. And all it takes is one person doing that in the neighborhood to have green June beetles for the whole area.
And what time of year do you treat the larvae then?
The larvae are treated primarily if you see them, if you see their burrows, and like I said, there'll be holes that'll be about a half an inch in diameter. Commonly underneath a tree, you'll have 50 to 100 of these things.
Right.
You can do those whenever those burrows show up. This is a little late to do that now, but earlier in the spring would work, or later in the summer if they appear.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. Our guest is Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist with the U of I and is here to try and help out with insect pest problems around the home. Give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You mentioned earlier, and I don't know if people caught this and mentioned sort of in passing, that the larvae of the Japanese beetle is the white grub that sometimes can people have problems with those in their lawn, and it
right.
can cause
uh-huh.
a lot of damage. If we could more aggressively control the grubs, would that be a solution to the Japanese beetle problem, or can you not, does it not exactly work that way?
It will. It will reduce it to some extent, but we get enough rainfall here naturally that we would have Japanese beetles regardless of people in their lawn situation. Certainly, irrigating the lawn increases the numbers of Japanese beetles in those areas. Although there are grub treatments that will control those beetles, we still get them coming out of all of the non-lawn areas that we have. We get them coming out of waterways in agricultural areas, roadsides, parks, meadows, every place where there's grass growing, we have Japanese beetles developing. And I have a little saying as far as them coming to your yard to feed on your trees: if you plant it, they will come. If you happen to have the right kind of trees that they like, such as lindens and crabapples and birches and willows, you will get the Japanese beetles in your yard, regardless of what you do, because when they go to fly every 3 days, they fly anywhere from 3/4 to a mile and a half, which brings them from other areas, even outside your neighborhood, into your area. So what you might do in your own lawn has very little to do with whether you're going to have Japanese beetles in your tree, because they'll fly right into your yard. And we live in a free country, so there's no way you can get everybody to do anything.
Hmm. Well, here's a challenging question for you, because this is really – I think this is actually coming from someone, not so much that they want to get rid of insects, but they want to attract some.
Uh-huh.
And this is a question that's come in off the air. This is someone who apparently is interested in attracting dragonflies
right.
to their yard. And they say that they put in two 250-gallon stagnant ponds early last summer. And he says, so far, he's only seen one dragonfly.
Well, we have we're involved in putting out ponds. We tend to have lots of dragonflies. We're native fish enthusiasts, and goldfish have an interest in goldfish. We have several ponds that are two or three ponds that are down in the soil, and then we have several other ponds that we just set up each year as stock tanks. All of those areas are usually loaded with dragonfly nymphs every year, and they have fish in them. And the fish keep the mosquitoes down, but the dragonflies seem to do well. I would suspect that this person maybe have started some ponds in some areas where there may not have been very many dragonflies. It's going to take a while to get used to them. Essentially, every year we have swarms of several hundred dragonflies flying around in our neighborhood, in our property, which is about 3.5 acres out in the country, and it's relatively well drained around. So most of them are probably coming from our ponds that we have. So they will come, but to make sure that your neighbors are not having a problem with what you're doing, putting some bait minnows in those ponds, or using some mosquito dunks, which have a bacterial material that lasts for about 6 weeks, to control the mosquito larvae is very important, because in a stagnant pond area, unfortunately, is where we will get northern house mosquito, Culex pipiens, which is a transmitter of St. Louis encephalitis and West Nile virus. So you could actually, having stagnant ponds without any mosquito control can actually be endangering the lives of the people around you.
All right. So you got to make sure you deal with your mosquito issue. And then it sounds as if if you're just starting to try to get these established, it might take a little time for the dragonflies to get onto the
right,
that
right.
that it's there.
Yeah. Yeah. But they will show up, I'm sure. And the more of an ecology you can have with plants in those ponds and fish in those ponds and so on, dragonfly nymphs are a natural part of that. And I think the more of an ecosystem you have with all of these parts in your aquatic areas, the more likely you are to have dragonflies.
All right. Well, let's get on to some other callers here. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And we will next talk with someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
I was digging around in my garden this weekend, and I found several large white grubs. They're mm-hmm. They're curled, maybe about half an inch long, mostly white with kind of brown and gray toward the head.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is, but I was thinking about getting some lawn treatment to kill them. Would that be a good idea?
At this time of year, we don't really recommend treatment for white grubs generally. It normally takes 10 to 12 grubs per foot square, a foot on each side, to provide enough, have enough grubs to cause turf damage. And we really don't recommend treatment for less than that, unless you've got, you can get raccoons or skunks coming in and feeding on the grubs at lower levels, and there it might justify the treatment. But generally, we don't recommend treatment with that, with small numbers of grubs. Generally, for the Japanese beetles we've been talking about now, and also the mass chafers, which are also serious turf pests, those are actually pupating right about now to emerge and just very soon. So generally, we don't recommend treatment at this time, but rather later in July or in August. But we do have the true white grub, which would have larvae present at this time of year. They generally tend to be relatively few in number. So if you've only seen an occasional one or two, I wouldn't worry about it. We also get these same white grubs showing up because they'll feed on a lot of dead organic matter in mulched flower beds and things of this nature. And unless you're seeing damage or dieback from your flowers, probably they're not something you need to worry about. They're just feeding on dead organic matter.
So if I waited until I saw brown patches in my lawn, would it be too late?
It wouldn't be too late. You might lose some of those areas of turf, and you might have to reseed or resod in those particular parts. But generally what we recommend is determine whether you have white grubs is you take a sturdy knife, go out in the first half of August, cut through the turf, pull it back, and count the grubs that are right there in the root zone in the 2 or 3 inches down below. And if you've got 10 or 12 or more per foot square, then we recommend treatment.
But it wouldn't help to do that now.
That's not going to help a whole lot to do that now. You would wait until early, first half of August, and that will be, you won't normally see damage to turf from white grubs until late in the second half of August. So you will be preventing the problem, but not unnecessarily using an insecticide.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, very good. Line two, line two in Savoy. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, hi.
I'll ask this and then I'll just hang up. But in Savoy, in the Arbors area, we have cicada killer bees.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen anything so massive in my life, and not that they're aggressive, but they are territorial. And
they don't appreciate you even you coming in their territory.
Oh, they're weird. They look like Harrier jets coming at you. And while they're really fascinating to watch as they carry the cicada, there are so many of them, and I was wondering if there was any way to control them.
Okay. Cicada killers are actually a type of wasp. They're 1.5 to 2 inches long, and the females will live in holes that are a quarter to a half an inch in diameter in the soil. The males establish aerial territories, which means they're flying around in an area, and anything that comes in that area, they approach. And to check out whether you're a female cicada killer that they would want to try to mate with or a male cicada killer they need to drive off. And typically what happens is you walk across the turf, you'll have this fairly large wasp hovering in front of your eyeballs, and then it will zoom around to the side of your head and to the back of your head as it checks you out. And looks meaner than all get out. The interesting thing is although cicada killers can sting, they're very reluctant to. You have to essentially be smashing them for them to retaliate in a sting. And the males that are so imposing on you are actually cannot sting because the stinger of a bee or a wasp is a modified egg-laying device, and males just flat don't have the equipment to even start to have a stinger. So it's all show, it's all intimidation, and you just refuse to be intimidated. Normally you can live with these things and not a big deal. If you want to get control on them, they tend to male their nests more in bare soil areas, so reducing those areas in your yard will help reduce the number of cicada killers. If they really bother you, Carbaryl or 7-Dust around the opening where they're going in and out will tend to kill the females. Once the females are dead, the males will go to greener pastures, so to speak. Yeah. So they will leave as well. So that's a way that you can control them, although they do help control some other insects. They would do some pollination activities, too, in some of their feeding. They're not considered to be be a really a serious pest. So living with them is a good option as well.
Yeah, this, I think from time to time we've heard from people who just said if there was one or two, that would be I could live with that. But they're saying that if there's 100, it's kind of a nuisance, and also it can do a fair amount of damage to people's.
Yeah, they will. Lawns. They will make masses of soil that looks somewhat like a fairly large anthill. It'll be usually about 6 inches across and about 2 or 3 inches high. So in some cases, they'll make holes that large and mounds that large. Several times, including last summer, we've had along our back walk somewhere around 15 or 20 plus velvet ants, winged velvet ants, which are parasites of a cicada killer. Back and forth, we probably had a total of 15 or 20 of them in a space of walk that was about 50 feet long. And I can appreciate how people get intimidated. My wife and I found them to be fascinating. But, we tend to be nature lovers. So I can understand why people would want to do something about them. The cicada killer is a native insect. Just because you had large numbers of them last year and seeing a lot of them this year doesn't mean you'll have them forever. Being native insects, generally, they will be numerous for about 3 years and then be very uncommon for 6 or 7 years, because being a native insect, they have natural enemies. These other parasitic insects I referred to, their diseases and so on, that will, when they get very numerous, nature knocks them down for a while and then they have to kind of build up. So bearing with it, don't get the idea you're going to have them forever.
All right. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign. This is line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm calling about white flies
uh-huh.
that I have on some potted hibiscus that uh-huh. I recently took from my sunroom indoors to my patio outdoors.
Okay.
When they were still in the sunroom, I had sprayed them with insecticidal soap.
Right.
I vacuumed them. It just, you know, they still have them, not to the degree that they did, but they're still there. And I wanted to know if there's a way to get rid of them.
Well, first place, hibiscus is just about like the best possible food you can find for white flies. White flies, for those people who haven't seen them, are going to be pinhead-sized or even smaller, about 6 or 8 of them on a pinhead, little tiny white insects that will fly when you disturb a plant. And they live as nymphs on the underside of the leaves, which are very small and almost clear and oval in shape. Moving your plant outside will do a lot to control the white flies for the summer, because natural enemies outside will chow down on them and greatly reduce their numbers without you doing anything else in all likelihood. We would recommend that, since you have a history of white flies, when you bring the plant in the fall, that, or maybe even for a couple weeks before you bring it in, that you would spray it probably on a weekly basis 2 or 3 times with insecticidal soap, making sure you get good coverage on the underneath side of the leaves, and then bring it in and watch for white flies showing up. Realize that you may, if you have other house plants, a source of them may be hanging out on other plants and not doing real well, so check your other plants, particularly the lower leaves on the underside, very closely for the nymphs, and treat those with insecticidal soap if you find them there, because they can be kind of your typhoid Mary for your hibiscus.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, and another caller here. This is someone in Danville, line 1. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering what the blue boxes in the trees were and what the difference is between an operator's license and an applicator pesticide license is.
Okay. The purple traps are, we like to call them Barney traps. Actually, they're emerald ash borer traps. They're about an inch wide and about 2 inches long, and they're triangular, and they're made out of corrugated plastic, and there are signs on the trunks of the trees saying what they are. What these are traps that have been put out around the state. They're about halfway done. They plan on putting about 4,000 around the traps. As of last Thursday, they had 2,200 put out. These are put out by the Illinois Department of Agriculture to determine whether emerald ash borer is in the area, which will eventually probably eliminate ashes from North America, ash trees. Very serious pest, an exotic pest from Asia. And so these are what they're there for. They will probably be removed somewhere around early August, and beetles will be looked for on those trees, on those traps, and it's a way of finding out whether the emerald ash borer is in the area. And so that's what they're all about.
Okay. What about the operator and applicator?
Oh, good point you brought that up. I'd forgotten that. We're looking in with pesticide licenses for those people who own or rent a land that they would be applying pesticides to, and they want to use restricted-use pesticides, that is those that are not available in garden centers and hardware stores that require special licensing to do so. They would get what we call a private license, which is the same thing farmers get for those types of pesticides. For a commercial person, if you're applying pesticides on property that you don't own, whether that's owned by the public, some other entities, even your church or other places, your place of business, whatever, or doing it for hire, you need what's called a commercial pesticide license. There are two, and that's required even for applying general use pesticides, those that you could buy in a garden center or hardware store. And because it's not on property that you personally own or rent, you have to have a license, a commercial license. And those are available from the Illinois Department of Public Health. A person applying a license, one person in the group has to have an applicator license. That means they have to pass a general standards exam and then one or more exams based on that type of application, where they're applying a pesticide. Trees is one, trees and shrubs are one, called ornamentals, turf is another one, etc. If you can also only have to have an operator license, that involves only one test, a general standards exam on general pesticide safety principles, if you work under the supervision of a person with an applicator license.
All righty. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Just real quick here, in about 30 seconds or a minute, we're here in Champaign-Urbana in Champaign County. Where, how close to us has the emerald ash borer actually been identified and said, yes, we know it's there, here is where it is?
How Interstate close? 80.
Okay.
Which is way north. We don't recommend treatment for emerald ash borer unless the borer has been found within 15 miles of you. And unless you're in the Chicago metro area or in the Peru LaSalle area, you should not be needing to treat for emerald ash borer because you're not within 15 miles of this insect.
So someday it'll be here in Champaign-Urbana,
yes.
But not now.
If somebody doesn't carry it in on firewood or hasn't already done so, it will take approximately 150, 200 years to get here.
All right. Well, then so we don't have to worry about that right away.
Although we may find it any time.
All right. Phil Nixon, extension entomologist from U of I. He's here occasionally. We talk about insect problems. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.